So, hi, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the next installment of our VR Hive podcast sessions. And I'm really pleased to say that I've took the hot seat this week instead of my good colleague, Laura Shearman, who is in the hot seat for being interviewed. So, good afternoon, Laura. How are you today?
Good afternoon, George. I'm very well. We're having an explosion of sunshine in the west. So I'm all camped out in my summer kit. Good to be here, and nice you put me in the spotlight.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've all enjoyed the podcast so far, Laura. And you've really kind of dug deep and asked some really great questions and had some really good guests. Some of them, of course, our own existing team. And I just wanted to turn the spotlight on you really this week by using your recent research document, the white paper, which, if you don't know, listeners, is available on our website, the VR Hive. It's a free download, so please go there, VR Hive, thevrhive.com, and get yourself a free copy of it. But I thought it would be good to verbally really bring to life, Laura, the fantastic work that you've done in pulling that together. Sure. But listen, for those who, before we get any further, who don't know you and don't know your background, I thought it'd be good for you just to intro yourself, tell us a little bit about your background, and before we go into the report itself. So could you do that for us just to kick things off?
Sure, yeah. So I wasn't always working in the space of edtech and virtual reality. My professional background spans two fields, so health and social care, in leadership and management positions, and education. So my expertise sits in kind of older people's care and support, and also technology and digital inclusion in that sphere. And probably the last year or so, I've kind of pivoted with the pandemic, and for different reasons, into edtech. So I'm now doing a PhD in education, which focuses on VR and how that is integrated into curriculum in the FE sector within health and social care curriculum. So I've got quite a diverse background. I've done lecturing in higher education, vocational training, and the FE sector as well, and also held sort of lead quality assurance positions as well for health and social care qualifications. And I've worked with the VR Hive since our inception at kind of the end of last year. So it's been a really interesting journey for me, and the report and kind of looking at the larger scale around, you know, VR and what's out there on a global scale has been really insightful.
So what did you think when you, I know our CEO, and I guess challenged you to go out there and kind of find out what we could find out so that we as a business can understand the problem and understand the fixes, so we could, you know, set up and grow our business really to where we are today, and more to do, of course. But what were you thinking even before you kind of put a stroke on your keyboard? What were you thinking about kind of how to even approach gathering all this information?
Yeah, I think I was quite excited by the challenge. I like a challenge. And I wasn't really aware of how big virtual reality was at the time. So I was interested to find out more from a sort of like global scale. And in terms of approaches, I mean, I've sort of not long done a master's and sort of PhD. So I was kind of looking at it from an academic perspective. So I kind of took the approach of, okay, this is going to be grey literature searches, and it's at kind of key terms, and what is it that we want to find out to align that to our objectives, to feed into our sort of business propositions and business values. So that's kind of the approach I took, really, and thought, this is going to be quite an interesting task. And I wasn't sure how big the report was going to be. I wasn't sure if there's going to be much to even really report on, what kind of questions I might be able to answer, if I could answer the questions I'd set myself. So it was quite a daunting piece of work with quite a bit of planning involved before I even got to actually retrieving that kind of secondary data and looking at kind of blogs, existing reports, industry case studies as well.
So you mentioned grey literature there. What was the other sort of mainstream of investigation you'd done?
Yeah, so the great literature is the main one. Within that, we also looked at LinkedIn, so scoured LinkedIn, looking for companies working in VR and soft skills, and looking at policy reports as well. So great literature is anything that's not really like published in an academic journal, basically. And looking at reports as well in papers, so if there's any kind of like headlines, because the pandemic has kind of really exploded technology, and there was a few headlines coming up in the press as well about VR, and also sort of Twitter feeds. So there's a few threads for me to make a start with to start investigating.
Sure. So the aim of the report then, so could you summarize just what the aim of the report was? What did you want to kind of set at the end and think, oh yeah, I've hit those kind of milestones?
Yeah, so we just really wanted to get a kind of current global and domestic overview of VR training, education and soft skills. So looking at who's out there, what are they doing, what training's being delivered, and kind of, you know, what are the topics which are being covered at that time, and also what are the kind of industry motivation for adopting VR, if there is any, and if any industry is actually kind of using it. So those were the kind of the main sort of threads that we want to draw out of this piece of research.
And I noticed on the document that you, as well as listing out that report, what it's seeking to achieve, that you kind of set out five key questions
to
I guess, answer yourself during that. So the first one was how many and where are VR soft skills training companies? So did it surprise you on how many or how few you found?
Yeah, I actually found 24 companies in total at the time. So I think as a piece of caution, that this was looked at back in the start of 2021, so January to Feb. So I suspect there's maybe a few more popping up now. But at the time, there were 24. With 8 located in the UK, the US, I think there were some like 4 companies, and then we had sort of the Netherlands, Germany, France, New Zealand, and the Ukraine. I was quite surprised that in the UK, we had even 8 in the UK, something that's such a new technology, and that we were actually kind of many ways ahead in that sense, the number of companies that we have working on this. So I was quite surprised by that. Finding.
What made you why were you so surprised about that? I mean, given that the UK is usually pretty innovative in terms of its approach, you look at even in medicine, etc., with the vaccines and stuff for the pandemic, was there something that kind of particularly stood out as a surprise to you?
Yeah, I think because the first time I ever tried a VR headset was around 2016 with the Oculus Rift, which was a tethered headset, and that was very new. So I knew that this was quite an emerging technology. And the other headset I had in mind was things like the Oculus Go and also the Google Cardboard. So I'd seen sort of pockets of VR popping up, but it wasn't something that I'd come across a great deal, hadn't seen a lot about it in the media. So for me, from sort of 2016 to where we are 2021, I was quite surprised to see this number of companies even sort of working in the space, particularly in soft skills, to be very specific. Yeah. Of course, we didn't go into looking at sort of the agencies that are out there designing and producing bespoke content. It's just specifically soft skills. So that for me was quite surprising, because soft skills hasn't really been a huge focus on the curriculum. A lot of it's more hard knowledge, technical knowledge. So that was those two real sort of surprises for me.
That's what I was just going to ask you, from a technical skills perspective, when you were researching to find the soft skills VR companies, did you find that you were having to sift through lots of technical VR companies?
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot more companies that were talking about sort of hard skills and sort of aviation, engineering. I think there was some VR work going around sort of Audi. There are lots of big companies manufacturing content for those huge enterprise customers, and sort of Airbus as well. But to actually find something very specific in soft skills, it was a bit harder. And a lot of that, yes, I went to LinkedIn, but I also used kind of blogs that I identified and kind of back searched where did they come from and any companies mentioned within their blog content to find them. So it, in some ways, it was a bit like trying to find a needle in a haystack. But once you got those first few links, and then sort of followed those strands of inquiry through, once you found a way in, it kind of opened up what was there. So that was quite...
Sounds like you had to be a bit of a detective to find out the information from one link to another.
Yeah, and I think as well, when you look at VR website, sometimes it's quite difficult to ascertain what it is they're doing, particularly with an agency, because they're quite broad brushed VR, but which bit of VR do you actually do? So it's kind of weeding through that as well.
And out of those eight or so that you found, the soft skills being offered by them, was there a top two, a top three, or what did you find out?
Yeah, I mean, soft skills encompass quite a broad range of skills, from critical thinking, problem solving, team working, leadership communication, microaggressions. But what really stood out in the kind of the examples I found, the ones that came out on top were in leadership, communication and conflict management. I don't necessarily know the reasons for that. I mean, if you think of something like speech VR, they are sort of communication-based company that focus on public speaking. So I guess VR is kind of like an obvious choice for that when you're trying to get people to rehearse presentation skills and you can get that virtual audience in place, which is really difficult to replicate or almost impossible to replicate in a real life because no one's got an audience to hand sit in that you can just whip out and go and practice. So that kind of seems like an obvious choice really, and same with kind of conflict management as well. So those are the kind of top ones, but I think there's a lot more, you know, we've just scratched the surface with this. There's a lot more that VR can do. There's a lot of exploration that needs to be done to see how VR can be used in things like teamwork. I mean, the VR Hive are doing work at the moment around, as you know, George, the sort of teamwork scenarios as well, and some more collaborative learning. So that's quite exciting. So I think these are the top three, but I think the VR Hive is going to be innovating in this area as well and breaking new ground just by virtue of soft skills that it's trying to approach.
Well, of course, the research you've done and putting it together has allowed us to focus on the next set of objectives for our business, of course. Leadership, problem solving, critical thinking. Did you find that when you were researching, because I noticed further down in the report that you researched your kind of training companies in general, and particularly in soft skills. So was there a kind of parallel to that? You know, that were those three kind of being taught in the e-learning world or the kind of stand-up workshop world just the same?
Yeah, I mean, there are some big players out there in soft skills companies who are in the e-learning market. I mean, e-learning is a saturated market, and there you can get the soft skills delivered in an e-learning module, but that tends to be the hard knowledge or theoretical knowledge rather than actually providing a space for employees to practice and apply those skills. And I think to note really that VR isn't the one-stop shop for everything. What it can do is it blends quite nicely and complements existing e-learning modules. And I think that there's a misconception out there that, you know, we're saying VR is the one-stop shop, that's it, job done, when actually it's a teaching and learning resource that can fit quite nicely into blended learning models or e-learning models or even in-person kind of workshops as well, because it gives that educator or that learner the exposure to real-world environment in the comfort of their own home or workplace. And it gives them that playground, if you like, to experiment and try out new interactions to understand the consequences.
Safely, without
a risk to the business. So it does create that safe space for that user to experiment and try different approaches to scenarios. And that's part of how we learn as well. I mean, even as kids, when we're born, we play with stuff. We get our toys, we got bricks out, we make towers. And we don't, as adults, we don't do enough of that to learn. We think we have to have it in this restrictive, right, this is the learning today, go and read this, click here, click that. When actually, we're all kids at heart, we want to go and play and experiment. That's the way our brains are. Mm. And that's the way that we engage best. And that's how we stay motivated with the content. And that's what VR can deliver at any time, almost anywhere on demand.
And I noticed that, just following on from that, if you think about industry and what their motivations would be to adopt VR, particularly in the soft skills environment, it's one of your questions, but what do you think industry is most cautious about?
I think I'm most cautious about breaking into something that doesn't have a very large evidence base, a piece of technology that's still quite experimental, and something that we're unsure at the moment. We're lacking solid longitudinal, so studies done over a longer period of time to show exactly what the return on investment is, because there is a conception that, you know, VR is expensive, but we have to acknowledge that these prices have come down over time, and we've got the consumer headset, the Quest 2, which is one of the fastest selling headsets out there now, and we've also got the lower end of VR, things like the Google Cardboard. Most people have got a smartphone. You can create content, live on that smartphone. It can be accessed and used and is still engaging as much as having a head-mounted display. So there's, first of all, the cost, I think, and the risk of, oh, is it going to be effective? Is it not? And I just think industry are not well informed about the benefits of this. There's not enough information being disseminated for them to understand how it works. How do we apply this in our existing teaching methods? And how does it align to our business objectives and strategies? And that information is just not being, these conversations aren't happening enough to make people understand it. I think as well, you know, the industry needs to be aware that there is a way that content can be built in a co-produced way with the companies which are building content. You know, we tried to, at the moment we're inviting in L&D professionals to work with us to inform that content. So we're trying to build it from the grassroots up rather than building something off the shelf and saying that will fit you. You know, it's a collaborative approach. It works two ways. So I think there's a caution that, oh, we're going to buy into that. That's going to be brought out for our business. But until you start kind of working with companies and having these discussions, there are opportunities, not just with the VR Hive, but other companies as well, for collaborations to happen to produce that meaningful content that businesses are looking for.
I totally agree with you. And I think what I really liked in the report, it's a little bit further down away from these five questions, but it's related to question three, is the way that you summarised five things that industry should be nudged on. Which I really thought was a nice term to use, which I think was your way of saying, hey, we need to poke industry to say, here's the benefits, here are the reasons that you should adopt this. And the first one you list down, which I thought was interesting, and having had a headset, or I get this part, of course, diverse realistic scenarios. What made you put that first?
I think that was one of the strongest themes that came out across the reports and blogs and literature that I kind of looked at. Employers like, industry likes the fact that you can build almost any scenario, any situation in VR at zero risk to that company. So you don't have to, there's no cost to setting up a real life simulation in the real world. Mm-hmm. You haven't got that expenditure. It's something that can be built in a VR headset, nice and tidy. The learner can do anything that they want to in there, experiment with their interactions, which harks back to my other point, and it can be done at any time. So it fits in, the training actually fits in at any point, or whichever company it is that it needs to fit into. Also it's worth mentioning, George, that this VR training actually expedites the training time. So you can take something like a 2-hour training session, I think Striver have reported this, it reduces down to a 15-minute session. I mean, that's quite incredible. And it's because the scenarios are so realistic that it's reducing that time, because you're not describing and talking about it. You're actually showing and getting that hands-on experiential learning in play.
And if you're in the immersive VR, you've got a headset on and you're not distracted, are you, by whatever's going on around about you. You're not looking at email, you're not checking a hangout message that's just popped through, or you don't see someone in the distance, you're immersed in that.
Well,
that kind of experience.
Let's face it, I'll admit this, you know, we get assigned e-learning modules from workplaces. Yeah, we do a quick click through. We want to get to the end, yeah, to the multiple choice test quickly. There's no cheating that in the VR environment. You've got to go through the learning and experiment with it. You know, you've got to be
you're
present.
You're in that, that's it.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that the second part on that kind of nudging list, you mentioned a little bit about it there, about there is a bit of a misconception that it's not cost efficient, but it obviously does have a positive effect on carbon neutral training, because you can do it from one location but involve people from all around the world. But there is a bit of a misconception, the cost thing, isn't it? Because there are different ways to experience VR, aren't there, that are cost efficient.
Yeah, there are lots of different ways of doing it. And I think on the PwC report, which is a well-known report on and their exploration into VR, I think they've identified it with something like, it's like 25 variables and 28 different calculations that are needed to work out what the return on investment is of VR. So it's a complex algorithm to calculate that. And a lot of the training, the pockets of training that we see, and they're siloed, so they're sort of like one-off, so it's a small pilot, it's not at scale. But I think we're starting to see a movement with the number of companies which are increasing the different offerings. I mean, you know, we're working on things now, body swapped, they're now in colleges and doing things that evidence is growing, and the longer that we're using the VR, the better that we'll see the return on investment. I think Lloyds Bank Group, they are currently running VR, they're piloting some VR, and they're expecting to save £175,000 in training costs over a two-year period. So that's not to be sniffed at in times when we are in turbulent, dare I say, economic times. You know, that's a real important saving. And employees are not taking such a long time off the floor either to go to their training. So there's a saving there as well. As well as having the learning, which is, you know, you've got a better, what we call ecological value to that training. So it means that when someone goes and does that VR training, it will translate well into real world context rather than just leaving it sat in a e-learning module and signed off and never looked at again, because they've actually been in that situation, that will transfer really well into the workplace. So that's a value in itself, which can only help to bolster the business's income and, of course, contribute to the wider economic recovery that Britain is currently starting to encroach on.
And the we spoke about the soft skills delivery, we mentioned it in the classroom, you've mentioned it by e-learning, but there is something to overcome there, and you did list that down as being one of the things we need to nudge industry about, that VR overcomes that. Did you specifically mean a kind of role play scenario? Because I know that's something that people just fear, don't they, when they kind of go to workshops
absolutely.
And stuff, but VR can take that away, can't it?
Absolutely. I think we've all been there when we've been in a situation, I don't know, you know, to managerial skills or leadership skills, and then the instructor says, right, you're now going to do a role play. You know, how comfortable and how confident are we with our acting skills, you know, to give a real kind of valuable piece of learning? Because it often is a bit kind of lighthearted, kind of fun. It's not taken that seriously. As if you've got the VR, it's got that sense of realism about it, that you just can't, no one's going to sit there and laugh, or that's not going to create a level of discomfort for that employee, because it's within that encapsulated environment where only they can interact with it, they can get their results, they know how well they're doing. So it kind of gives that sort of security in learning as well, in that learning environment, that safe space we mentioned earlier.
Yeah. And I think when you mentioned blended learning earlier, which is a term that I think most people will be familiar with. And, you know, the kind of fourth point about nudging industry you've mentioned is about multimodal learning. And I guess that kind of maybe explain a bit more about that, but that's something that industry, if they understood that and understood that what we're not saying is it's VR and there's nothing else you'll ever do in your life again. That's not what we're saying. We're saying let's blend this together, aren't we?
Yeah, we're trying to say that it's going to complement what's already there. So there's a lot, as well as the blended learning, there's a shift towards micro-learning. So micro-learning is basically bite-sized chunks of learning, which are easy digestible, so they're short bursts of learning. And we are great for that. You know, we build something like a 15-minute scenario. We've got a lot of engagement, the learner's focused, they're learning. It's a real powerful, memorable piece of learning, as opposed to trying to throw somebody through a 20-minute piece of e-learning what they're not going to remember. It's not going to have that impact. And I think we have to be mindful as well that technologically, the way that the environment is going, the culture, our workplace culture, the infiltration of tech, is that we are seeing a change in people's expectations of training, particularly with the younger generations coming up through as well, Generation Z. They're expecting training sort of on demand, bite-sized chunks. You know, gone are the days of the didactic teaching of being in the classroom and the trainer knows everything in the room. They're now sort of facilitating and the employees are wanting their sort of in control over their learning, which I think is an exciting prospect, but also understandably quite a challenging idea for some educators if you've been used to doing it so long in such a way. So there's that side which could be also contributing to a reluctance to try that VR technology as well, because it's letting go of that safety blanket. We've done that for so long, that's how it's always worked. Yeah. And saying, well, we've got to tear that up now and bring something else in. But I think if you did that in incremental stages and you just sort of a pilot of something and you've had the kind of support with the trainer around it to explain the way it fits, how it would work to complement what they already do, like you said, we're not replacing it. We're actually trying to enhance what's already there.
The experience. Which leads on to the last point on that kind of nudging list, which is about getting industry to understand the value of soft skills, training soft skills in VR. And I guess that's all of 1 to 4. It's like, can I put it all together and say there is a bit of the ROI. You mentioned that earlier on, but there is a bit of a question around, as there always is with training. It doesn't matter whether it's e-learning, stand-up delivery, the kind of leadership of whoever the organisation. Mm-hmm. Will always say, right, it's going to cost me this, what am I going to get back? So no different with VR, I guess. Is that anything that came up in some of the research?
Yeah, and I think it's important to say as well that, you know, we've all got different ways that we like to learn. You know, it's all different learning styles, and the e-learning is to my mind a one size fits all. It's not, you know, it's not a good approach to learning. You know, you've got to bring in some diversity there, I think. And particularly industry, I think 66% of employers have reported soft skills shortages in the workforce. So there's a real recognition that soft skills is important and that there needs to be action to increase employee soft skills, particularly in the face of automation. So it really is becoming an industry need, and the longer it's left hanging and made more complicated with geographically dispersed workforces, the worse that may get. So we actually need some action now to stop soft skills, you know, deteriorating further, which could impact on the workforce and wider economy.
And of course we've talked about headsets, but you do know in the report you kind of segment kind of three types of VR essentially. So do you just talk us through, I think when people who are listening will probably immediately say, yeah, I've seen a headset and that must be what it is, but just kind of talk us through the three kind of broad categories and any more that's maybe come up since that post.
Yeah, cool. So there are three key types really that we'll talk about. There's the immersive virtual reality, the IVR. So that's where you've got the headset, you might have a hand controller, and you're completely immersed in that environment. You then got something called semi-immersive VR. So that's kind of a cross between non-immersive VR, where non-immersive is where you might be interacting with a virtual world using a computer. It's sometimes known as sort of desktop VR. So you're not, or you can access it on a tablet, so you don't have any headsets. Semi-immersive VR sits between the two of them. So you can still see what's going on around you in the real world, but you can still interact in the virtual world as well. So for example, best example I can think of are things like the F1 simulators. You know, we've got the big screens, panoramic screens, and they're sat in the F1 racing car and they're steering and things moving. And on a more kind of efficient note is something like Google Cardboard, where you've got the clip of the headset which goes over the phone, you hold your phone up and you can see the content, you can interact with it, but you're still in touch with the real world as well. Exactly. So all of these are types of VR, and they're all effective, always been shown to be really effective in training, particularly the semi-immersive VR and the fully immersive VR. So they're all options. And then you've got your non-immersive, where you can offer that out to be inclusive. So if an employee doesn't have a headset, or you've got a limited number, there are ways of still offering that out there to the workforce at a reduced rate and affordable cost.
Yeah, of course, that's the Cardboard, which I know we've used in the VR Hive, and we've kind of scoped out some projects for people and organisations using that type, which is really good.
I think it's worth noting as well that when you look at these different types of VR, so 360 VR and fully immersive VR, is that they do different jobs. So the 360 VR is a 360 film. You can still have interactive elements embedded in there, and that it's a real life film. Now that is great. That's what you need for some simulation. So if you're going to have a challenging conversation, or you want to show sort of a leadership skill, or you want to immerse someone in a meeting with real people, and you need to see that body language happening, that is going to be your best way. Because if you take the immersive VR, we are limited on the number of facial expressions that we can convey in an avatar. You know, we've been in VR, we've not been able to move our feet in VR, you know, about having to buy some fancy bolt-on to put on there. So, you know, that's limiting. But what immersive VR does allow you to do is interact in really amazing and diverse environments. So it's a very interactive space and very collaborative as well. So, for example, teamworking, if you need a teamwork scenario, you can bring people into that immersive VR world, which you can't do in the 360 VR. So when you're looking at these different options, you need to match the VR solution to the problem or to what you're trying to do. Because none of these solutions is a tick box for everybody. They've got their benefits and their drawbacks, and you need to sort of weigh those up.
I guess it's when you've kind of listed down those three types, that was my next question, and you answered it before I asked it, which was, you know, where does 360 VR fit in, and where does graphical VR fit in the VR Hive? We're working with clients, as you well know, that kind of want one or the other for different reasons. Yeah. With 360, you mentioned there challenging conversations, for example. So why do you think 360 VR is like so much better fitted, to using graphical in that scenario?
Yeah, I'll draw on the health and social care background for me on that one. Is in health and social care, if you're going to have like an end of life discussion, you know, you need to see people's facial reactions, you need to see get a feel of dynamic in the room. If you have something like that replicated in a graphical sense in immersive virtual reality, it's a representation of reality. As what you've got in the 360 VR, that is a reality, and it's just a scenario in the words, which are the things which are made up. You know, it's a scenario. But the graphical VR, for me, from my personal view, and from my, you know, looking back on the training I've done with staff in the past, it shifts away. It's too far displaced from reality. As a 360 VR, it's, first of all, it's cheaper. It's accessible on a smartphone. And they've still got this interactive element to it as well. So it is a really good option in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what we're through, haven't we? When we've been putting together some of our initial pilot work and MVP mm-hmm. creation for people, that we found that that's much more realistic. Whereas the work we're doing with the graphical VR, it's kind of, dare I use the phrase, gamification feel to it. But that was my next question. So we're currently working on an MVP at the moment, as you well know, which is, it's for teamwork and collaboration, communication skills, etc. So why is the graphical avatar feel, why does it fit so well with something like those soft skill topics, like the one we're doing with communication skills in that environment?
Yeah, I think we're also working on sort of the teamwork aspect of there as well, and problem solving, is that you can create any problem that you want to in that space, and everything that the learner is inside as an avatar, that they can interact with the entire environment. If they want to move something, if they want to change something, if they want to explore the environment, see what's in it to help them solve a problem, they can do. They've got that ability, and they can also work collaboratively with their colleagues in that same space to solve a problem. So it's pretty amazing, because it brings people together that may be at different geographical areas, and allows them to come together to solve a problem in VR in any environment that you want it to be. As you just can within a 360 VR, it's limited. You can only get that kind of normally single user going through an experience, selecting options, and that's kind of as far as it goes. Yeah. But the graphical VR, you've got that collaborative learning that can take place, and you can view almost anything that you want in there. I mean, Professor Gary Burnett at Nottingham University, he set out Mozilla Hubs. He built a Mozilla Hubs environment for his students to collaborate with and to deliver and to access content for his module. And the beauty of it was that people could come together, they could interact with each other, they could talk to each other, and it brought the learning to life. And I think he was doing ergonomics, and he could take bits of the car off and show them, and they could get inside the car. So it's far more interactive than just having him say, filmed in 360, giving a lecture or talk about it. It brings that learning to life, which you can't get that same amount of interactivity in that 360 sense.
And I guess that fits really well, actually, with the, in the report you list down some of the benefits of VR. And I think you've just explained two of them, but I'm just going to check with you. You talk about it increases user engagement and co-presence.
Yeah. So, if you bring in a bit of tech, I mean, there are some people that are not interested in technology, that's fine, but they may be curious about it. Well, what's that? I'm going to have a go. What is that world like? So it's got that curiosity about it to try something new. Yeah. Compared to, you've got an option there, a new learning module or a bit of VR content. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like my dad, he had to do an e-learning module recently. No, didn't want to do it, not motivated. I was speaking to him the other day about VR. Oh, that's really interesting. So straight away, my dad's like in his 60s, he's almost retired. He's interested in that to engage with it. So there's that curiosity. Well, how does that work then? What is it about? In terms of co-presence is just the way that we describe feeling as if you're in the environment and you are with other people as if you were in person in reality. So, the team's always on these conference calls, these video conferencing calls on a daily basis, and we do some meetups in the VR space. The VR space is much nicer because you feel like there's a natural person, you're talking to another person, it feels like you're in the same space and a shared space together. As I'm on video conferencing call, it's obviously I'm here, you're there, you don't have that same sense about it.
Yeah.
You do feel dispersed.
Yeah, and you can, you're right, we have had lots of meetings as a team in the virtual world, and you look around, you literally do a 360 on environment you're in, so it does make you feel closer.
And you can do fun stuff, like we put cars in there and little animals and plants and things, and before we start the meeting, so you've got that, it's nice, it's a playful environment, and people sort of, every time we've gone into VR, we've always laughed about something. And we have our conference calls, it's quite, we don't have as much fun on a video conferencing call as we do in VR, I don't think.
Well, I think you'll agree, and the listeners would agree, that there's to use a phrase that's going around just now, a kind of Zoom fatigue happening around the world. So it's good to have a little break from that, to get into the not so real, but it does feel real world.
Yeah, and I think as well, sometimes what we end do as well is you go between the video conferencing call and in VR. So sometimes we flip between the two.
Yeah.
And that's great because you've got basically two spaces that we're connecting with each other to.
Yeah.
So again, that helps you feel more connected as part of a team just by using those three different spaces, which is a really interesting dynamic and one which is starting to be explored and thought about a bit more in learning spaces. So it's an exciting time.
Absolutely. I think the only question we've not spoke about so far is the one around teaching and assessment methods. That I know that was one of the five questions. We've covered them all off, bar that one. And I wanted to touch on that to get so the listeners know, you know, at the VR Hive, we want to provide learning episodes both for industry, but of course for higher and further education. So teaching and assessment methodology was definitely a question we were always going to get you to look at. So what did you find out? How could you summarise that part of the report for us, Laura?
Yeah, so predominantly you've got two types of assessment. You've got AI, artificial intelligence in VR, and then you've got off the old human assessment, you know, someone looking at the evidence, reviewing it and identifying, you know, if that's your learning outcomes met or if someone's done really well on that. So the human assessment in VR, the way that potentially works is by having a recording of the session and then the assessor goes away and reviews it and listens to what's been said and analyses that. So, you know, that's really good because it allows the assessor to pick up, you know, what exactly has been spoken, what was the meaning behind and the application of the phrasing or ideas that were presented, which something like artificial intelligence may misinterpret. So I think something like 46% of the different parts of training that I identified in the report mentioned using AI. So AI is basically making a machine behave like a human, so it's trying to replace the human basically. So in the context of VR, it's basically looking at making numerical meaning of human interactions that then translates into feedback. So for example, if you did something like a teamwork task, you might have metrics or measures, could be sort of the number of words spoken, tone of voice somebody uses, number of interactions between users, because then you can get a nice social network analysis chart done. And what that enables learners to do when they have that feedback straight away, well, first of all, it's instantaneous. At the end of the scenario, there's your data, boom. They can reflect on their learning straight away and think, oh, that's tricky, I'm good there, next time I might need to do this. So it allows them to reflect on their learning immediately. And so the human assessment, it takes a bit longer, but you do get the more sort of nuanced and detailed feedback, which is obviously useful as well. So those are the two main areas. I mean, I'm not going to go into the assessment method and observation, testing, things like that.
Sure,
but
on a
big broad brush platform, those are the two type of assessments that we are seeing. And I think there's probably a space for both in terms of having AI feedback immediately, but having a recording of that content, if it's a teamwork scenario, for example, so the assessor can see what it is that learner did and what they're reflecting on and what they need to improve on. So I think there's probably space for both of these approaches.
There's more detail in the report, isn't there, of course, if people...
Yeah, and to be fair, metrics and AI is important in both industry, corporations, and also actually education is also looking more for metrics as well. So I think we're going to see a lot of growth in that area in the future.
Yeah, and I think just on the word education there, I know you're, as you told us your story, you're from an education background, and you know, learning pedagogy and is really important in all of teaching, no matter what sphere it's in. And so tell us a little bit about the work we are, as a result of doing the report, and we want to do at the VR Hive to really innovate on and develop a new part of a digital pedagogy that allows to be the blueprint to use VR in education.
Yeah, so I think really we're looking at, so pedagogy is just the way, the methods that we use to teach somebody what's the underpinning idea behind it. And VR lends itself to really three key pedagogies. So behaviorism, constructivism, and experiential learning. So behaviorism is basically where we take an action and then we understand what the impact is immediately after. So you said this, you've chosen this option, and this was the result of it. So if you're managing a challenging conversation with somebody, you've chosen to say the wrong thing, then that gives you that feedback straight away. So that's one of the approaches, pedagogies. The constructivism is kind of contextualized learning. So when knowledge is generated through interaction, so by interacting with the environment, and it's a very active process. So VR is a really great vehicle for that, because it allows users to engage in all different types of environments and experiment with different interactions to really explore the learning environment, which those two approaches alone are something that we are, you know, we've got underpinned in our new scenario that we're building. And of course, the experiential learning, which is learning by doing. So, you know, things like learning the principles of conflict management, you could have that as a standalone VR approach where you give someone that and then they just go and try different ways of resolving a conflict. When they eventually get the right answer out, those are the principles of conflict management, about actually having to be really explicit about what they are to start with. So it's kind of those three areas. It is worth noting that the pedagogical frameworks which VR sits on are not well explored, and they're often not really explained or talked about in a lot of the VR content. We don't see a lot of that talked about in academic papers either. So it's an area that there is a lot of development to do and a lot of work to see how that would work within the framework of a wider framework of digital pedagogy, which is just basically the study of how digital technologies can be used to best affect teaching and learning. So looking at combinations of technology and how they can be used in concert with each other to support learning. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of work to be doing. I'm sure over the next kind of 5 years, there'll be a lot of new different approaches and pedagogies being developed, which VR will sit in.
You mentioned there about the kind of research and that's been done already, and there's clearly a lot missing and a lot still to be done. And one of the reports that you've discovered, that we've all discovered it in our team, that we go to look at is the PwC report, which is, you mentioned it earlier on, of course. And so on your report, you mentioned the PwC report, but what can we, limited as that may be, but what can we learn from it? What did you take the most from it, I guess, that report? Because that was a great report, but it was only in one kind of one event that they done.
Yeah, I think what we have to be really mindful is that VR is still a very new training resource. So a lot of the work done that's popping up are quite small studies, and they're only done few months.
Incredibly detailed, of course. Yeah, I mean, hats off to
absolutely. There's some great detail in the PwC report, but with that, you know, I don't think there were, the hand controls weren't used in that, and there wasn't sort of the voice recognition wasn't put in there either. So that's sort of just a little tip of the iceberg, really. I think what we need to do, and what that really shows for me, is the amount of work that has to be done. And you know, academic literature is one thing, that's an academic community, but what we really need to be doing is working in collaboration with industry to run pilots and build content and test them and find things out about them. And we need to be confident and not shy about sharing what's worked and equally what hasn't worked, because if something hasn't worked, that is as valuable as something that has worked. And I think what we could really benefit from is some sort of kind of, you know, best practice or industry practice VR network, where there is a safe space for people to share the work that they're doing, because there's bound to be a lot more happening than what we're seeing reported on. The internet can only take you so far. There'll be lots of things, pockets of people trying things that we don't even know about, you know. So it'd be great if people could come forward, contribute these, whatever they're doing, even if they think, well, it's not really anything, because these are all little seeds of knowledge that we can use to build that bigger picture, really.
Well, yeah, I mean, that here at the VR Hive, we absolutely want to develop training and learning episodes in conjunction with partners and with people, organisations, corporate and education establishments that allow us to tap into evaluation and can involve the end user, because there's no use us thinking, yeah, that's going to be fit for purpose. We need to develop this stuff hand in hand. And you know, we for those listening, whenever you're listening to this recording, we'll still be looking, I'm sure, in the coming months for partners, for pilots. We'll still be looking for people to join our steering group, which kicks off at the end of this month. So you know, all the information you're going to need, and we're forever changing and updating and tweaking and presenting our website and our business in the most up-to-date fashion, reflecting the work we're doing with pilots, and then putting ourselves in a different direction if need be. So you'll find everything up to date all the time on the VRHive.com. But Laura, what an absolute pleasure to dig deep into the tremendous work, several months of work, I'm sure. And I know there's been many a late night kind of putting it together. And please, listeners, you must go and download this free report off the VRHive.com. Laura, thank you so much.
It was
great to take over the hot seat on this occasion. Thank you.
Yep, no problem. Great to be part of this journey. And thanks very much.
Right, thank you.
Well, that's it for this edition of the Inside Education VR Hive podcast. A big thanks to Laura for giving us more insight into her recent white paper. If you're listening and would love to be involved in our next or a future podcast, then please do get in touch. And also get in touch if you want to be part of our steering group. Thanks, and we'll see you on the next podcast.